Gresham College presents Leadership and Change, Prime Ministers in the Post-War World, Margaret Thatcher, by Professor Keith Middlemass.
What you say only reinforces my diffidence about ground that I haven't actually visited for nearly 15 years. However, I will do my best. I don't preach to a text, but if I did, I would take something from Henry Kissinger. What we want is not more secret knowledge, but the better analysis of what we already know. That's what I shall try to do. I shall ask questions rather than retail 10 long years. And the basic one is the question that affects all biographers. What did she actually do, as opposed to her cabinet, her civil servants, her times, the great forces that move mankind? And what, if anything, does Thatcherism now mean in a very different world from when it started in the 1980s? I put that as a number of questions. What did she bring to the office of Prime Minister? What was the nature of her power to do things? And in three aspects, what was she responsible for after 1979? The economy, the structure of power in the state, world affairs, and Europe. Many of you may have known her. You will all feel differently about her, and you will no doubt all have different questions. You would answer differently. The first one, what was it that made her eligible to be Prime Minister? Papabile. There's no memorable track record like Lloyd George or Churchill. There's no long party or bureaucratic formation like Attlee and Wilson. And in some ways, she's more like Baldwin. There is an accidental element. Her political formation is well known. John Campbell's book gives us a blow account in two volumes. And we start with that small town upbringing, rising middle class aspirations, the influence of her father, of Methodism. Those are keynotes. And then there's the reaction. As a young woman, she discovers the world of London and ends up at Oxford. But that's not the Oxford of England War. This is hard work, reading always for a purpose, an ambitious woman in a pre-feminist environment. With an intense dislike of snobbery, of which there was plenty in Oxford and Cambridge, and a woman who discovers politics through the University Conservative Association, and discovers also the virtue of certainty. She marries a wealthy businessman. The result is that her family lifestyle is to some degree absolved of the drudgery of motherhood. And that's not meant as a snide remark, it's just simply true. She's not smart, but she's well-dressed. She's not an intellectual, and she has a rather narrow worldview. She doesn't travel in foreign parts, she speaks no other languages. She spends a brief time studying law, and then she becomes, for Finchley, a standard 1960s biographer. A standard 1960s backbencher. She has a period as a junior job at pensions, and she's excellent there in briefing herself. She becomes the statutory woman in the shadow cabinet with the post of education. Already, and this is important, by 1968 she's linked to the Institute of Economic Affairs, to people like Arthur Seldon, Keith Joseph and Geoffrey Howe. But she's still, and perhaps always was, a listener rather than a contributor. Then in the Heath government, she does 3.5 years at education, showing a great deal of competence rather than brilliance. She wasn't a book snatcher, that's an absurd taunt. And it may well be that she saved the Open University. But she was excluded from the policy-making corps. Heath did not actually like her, but saw her usefulness. And as a minister, she felt manipulated to some degree by her officials. And she developed future techniques for managing them, including sometimes roughing them up. And of course, as one would expect of a junior member of the cabinet, she went along with the prices and incomes policy and entry into the European community in 1973. But one should note that she's already coalescing with a second generation of who perhaps ought to be described as ideologues. People like Alfred Sherman, Alan Walters. And if an alternative approach was needed to Heath, then the ideology existed and she was part of it and had the support of a small group of enthusiasts. Of course, one after the other, the alternatives to Heath dropped out. Enoch Powell first, Winnie Whitelaw waited perhaps for the second round, Keith Joseph dropped out at the last moment. She was accidental then, only insofar as her test run against Heath became the real thing, and plus the intensive promotion by Airy Neave and Gordon Rees. It became the final run. And that was the reward for what one has to acknowledge was sustained determination and courage in standing up. Now she's leader of the opposition, and she was going to win if Labour destroyed itself. And of course, by 1979, the Labour government had destroyed itself. Her part, and it was accentuated by Heath's personal hostility towards her, was to convert the party by degrees. Firstly, to take control of the organisation, to take control of central office, and to downgrade the research department, to make really quite sure that there was no alternative theology. The second point was the formation of a political core, Whitelaw, Peter Thornycroft, Lord Carrington, and a second rank, Humphrey Atkins, Airy Neave. These would be her stalwart supporters in the early years. She began to develop strong links to the backbenchers, and she used conference brilliantly, aided, of course, by that gifted speechwriter, Ronald Miller. And we find Norman Tebbit and Nicholas Ridley moving up on the inside track among her private colleagues. In public, she demonstrated a blend of temperate public language on some issues, such as social and education policy, and the European community. She was tough on the Cold War and Soviet Union, and she found the Iron Lady brand very useful. In private, she was definitely part of the planning process, and that fount of ideas stemming from the Institute of Economic Affairs, with the CPS as its meeting place. She's still, I think, in that respect, a pupil observer. Note that one of the documents of that period, Stepping Stones, published in 1979, not published, but written in 1979, was put aside as being too much for the public at that stage. By the late 70s, she has fully formed views, and among them stand out that the corporate state as it had developed since the war was a failure and was now intolerable. That there should be more space for ideas of individualism and individual morality and responsibility, that wealth creation was a good thing, that property aspirations were desirable in a mixed economy, and that the state should be seen as a benign regulator, no more. Meanwhile, of course, the packaging went on. The voice changed, the accent changed, the hair changed, and the hats changed. It was, if you like, an exercise in Saatchi branding. And the brilliant slogan, Labour isn't working, for the 1979 election. She didn't make up to the BBC, she made up to ITV and the tabloid newspapers and rather than the broadsheets. And there is, I have to say, an element of truth in Reggie Maudling's snide remark that if you feed a grub royal jelly, it will turn into a queen bee. In sum, by 1979, she is by party a convinced conservative. In terms of philosophy and outlook, she's a classical 19th century liberal. And she is driven. And this is not Methodism. I think it's much earlier, but also, if you like, geographically the same area that she came from, Grantham. This is Puritanism. This is Bunyan's Pilgrim on a long march. And the pilgrim on the march carries in her handbag a copy of Weber's Protestant Ethic and several books from the Scottish Enlightenment, Adam Smith, David Hume, Ferguson. I have an image, a photograph from 1979. It shows the shadow cabinet all around a table in the House of Commons. They're all smiling, rather fixed, formal smiles. There's only one natural smile, and that is hers, and she is showing a very well-rounded row of white teeth. What were the sources of her power? Never ignore the damnable inheritance of the economic recession of 1980-81. It was a bad time to introduce a new governing regime. And the boats were very soon burnt, by which I mean the sort of crisis management modes of the 60s and 70s. It was the severest test of her whole decade, and the underlying question was, would a government led by her bend when the recession got to its worst, or would it sail, like Captain McQuarrie in Conrad's novel, through the typhoon itself? Well, she had a cabinet call, and this was crucial in the early years. Herself, Keith Joseph, Geoffrey Howe as Chancellor of the Exchequer. And the only real critic, and he was there for several reasons, was Jim Pryor, holding the labour market and the trade unions relatively quiet. And behind them were the coming younger men like Nigel Lawson and Arthur Cofield. Her cabinet was actually more open than Heath's, and real, in the sense that discussion did take place, and the phrase sofa government would have been way out of the mark. But there was no voting. She reserves the right to demur, to divert, or simply ignore disagreement, hoping that Whitelaw and Carrington would see her through. Of course, she was very well briefed, but also overworked herself. She interfered restlessly, almost endlessly, to the eventual exhaustion of many of her colleagues. Everything had to go to number 10, and she reserved the right, especially with the so-called wets, and later on with Lawson and Howe, to leak, to give unattributable briefings, and to use Bernardingham in ways which have since become more familiar. As for her colleagues, she inspired great loyalty, sometimes even love, but not, I think, friendship. Her mission was not to bring harmony, but enlightenment. And there was a certain recklessness, an ability to stand aside, as if this were not her government at all. Over the decade, as some ministers dropped out, others were sacked, she became more isolated and lonely. And there was a parallel with Queen Elizabeth I in her latter years. She became more vulnerable to affairs like Heseltine's management of the Westland affair, and at the very end, the entry to the European, to the exchange rate mechanism in the late 1980s. Party and conference, on the whole, captured and stayed captured. Harold Watkinson was her chosen party chairman. And the party was held right to the end, and every conference year on year there were rhetorical trials. But by the end, the backbenchers in Parliament were eroded, and her advisers feared at the very end to say that on the second ballot on the leadership, she probably no longer had a majority. Press and television I've mentioned already. There were great skills of image projection, Ian Gow as well as Bernardingham, and Miller for the speeches. And the ITV and the tabloids were on the whole supportive, perhaps use the word servile, not least because, of course, in their own patch, their own trade unions, the print unions, needed to be demolished also. Whitehall was a complicated area. From the start, there's a new climate, Treasury dominance rather than the spending departments. And there's a division, almost a preacher's division, those for and those against. And the friendly symbiosis of ministers and permanent secretaries disappears. This is a true sea change, and it governed promotion to the top jobs. And over the years, I think it has led to a transition to a mechanistic view of officials, roles and duties. They were not énarques in the French mode. They were not to be advisers on policy. They were not to define the national interest, and this has become deeply entrenched among her successors. And from the start, there was a hardline approach, Rayner's efficiency unit, and a culture which led to assent rather than consent. That's quite different from her attitude towards what I like to see as the state's guardians, the military and the intelligence services, for whom she had great and continuing respect. And what Vernon referred to as the institutions of the post-war era, what some call the corporate state. Well, the CBI, the Confederation of British Industry, had been close in her opposition years, perhaps under John Metham even a little too close. But, and John Davis indeed, was given a ministerial job at the beginning. But the heads of industry, even though they still had access to Downing Street, were distanced from policy making. The city is not yet a player, not till the late 80s, and the financial services boom under the single market and the era of Big Bang. But one has to remember the great influence of the Bank of England and that gifted governor, Gordon Richardson, in the evolution of economic management and monetary policy. Trade unions had no access at all. Not even Len Murray, who was desperately trying to hold out a role for the TUC, which would be different, and in despite of the radical left and the orage in the public sector trade unions and the NUM. Really, the best the TUC could do in those dismal years for them was to retain a link with Jim Pryor, a temperate labour market policy, and let the National Union of Mine Workers go down to its own folly. And finally, when we're thinking of the sources of power, the public. There wasn't a lot of mileage in voting for the Labour Party in these wasted years, hence the rise and the popularity of the Alliance. And Margaret Thatcher had two great advantages. She knew that the support of the white-collar workers in the Midlands and the South East was pretty certain. After all, fewer of them had voted Labour than in any year since 1931. And secondly, there was a culture of enemies at which she excelled and which played extremely well in the popular press and elsewhere. Russia was an enemy, trade unions were an enemy, the bureaucrats, the IRA, the Argentine generals. And how did she use this power? Personally, she could out-argue, out-maneuver, and dismiss, and sometimes, as with Geoffrey Howe at the end, with ignominy. After 1981, she no longer needed a tutorial education, even by Keith Joseph, and she barely needed advice except on technical questions, such as military matters. Remember that famous scene before the Falklands War began? House of Commons debate is about to take place, and Admiral Sir Henry Leach comes in to a private meeting in uniform, and she says, "Can we do it?" And he says, "Yes, it will not be easy, but you can." And that really seems to have sparked her. She could and did use her femininity and charm her colleagues backstage. And I think she had no need of what we would now see as a sisterhood, 15 years too early for that. She was lonely, which made it so important that she had a husband waiting in number 10. She was vulnerable, but she could ignore the taunts and often, as with the Iron Lady, turn them to advantage. Although whether she actually looked at Gerald Scarfe's cartoon picture of her, I do not know, nor whether she heard that remark of François Mitterrand that she has the mouth of Marilyn Monroe but the eyes of Caligula. And certainly, she said what she believed was true. And that's very different from those, perhaps now, who believe that what they say must be true because they say it. The first case that I want to look at, and I hope it's not a dull one, is the economy that transformed the period and apparently cut the trade unions down to size. She and her Treasury Corps had concluded that not only was the post-war state wrongly constructed with a mandate to run the macroeconomy on neo-Keynesian lines, but that it had been proved wrong by what had happened in the 1970s. There should be an end, therefore, of corporatism, the triangle of government, industry, labour and finance, and it should be replaced by the imposition of strict rules which would preclude negotiation and prevent, and which pressure groups could not defeat. It would be hard, but they, not just her, they assumed that there would be a short initial shock, a rational public response, and then a virtuous circle. The problem was that 1980-81 was a very severe recession, and the public response was variable rather than rational, often very hostile. And even if the new enemies were clear enough, inflation, public sector costs, public sector pay, it wasn't a straightforward battlefield. And as time went on, it became more like Tolstoy's account of the Battle of Borodino, a soldier's battle in the smoke where you could hardly see the enemy at all. Also, monetarism, as it was called at the time, was a theory, not a rule. And it had only one instrument, interest rates, at this time called minimum lending rate. And even Keith Joseph's closest allies and the IRA had not been certain how it would work in practice and whether to rely on it as M1, M2, M3, or MO. And as the complexities unraveled clarity, the wider cabinet became uncertain and even appalled at the price. And the theorists had given way to the practical people who were now in charge. You don't get Hayek and Friedman advising. Indeed, after it was over, Friedman criticized the whole exercise. So, a fixed rule replaced macroeconomic management, allied to supply-side reform, which was intended to encourage deregulation and real organic growth. But this is a vast scenario. Back to the battlefield, things are taking place all over the canvas. And the supply-side reforms actually came last, despite Keith Joseph's best efforts. And Margaret Thatcher's work was focused on holding the Treasury core together and driving on. And this is the converse of post-war crisis management, especially what was done in the Heath period in 73 to 75. One should also remember that some of this had been prepared during the IMF crisis in 1976 when Denis Healy was Labour Chancellor. What she gave was direction, a populist imagery, an implacable language in public, and honed it literally as if there was no alternative. And the shock was the first budget, Geoffrey Hayer's first budget in March 1980, and the medium-term financial strategy reinforced in his second and third budgets in successive years. Of course there was uncertainty about it in cabinet, but the so-called wets, of whom Jim Pryor was the head probably, had not prepared for the March 1980 budget, and they were dispersed as a potential force. They actually didn't have an alternative. The same went in Whitehall and in the parliamentary party, but the uncertainties remained about which rule and the limits of MLR. And Gordon Richardson and the Bank of England were not in much sympathy with Margaret Thatcher's private advisers like Alfred Sherman and Alan Walters. And Pryor was asking from within the centre a deep and pertinent question: what is the national interest? Do we have a national interest in the survival of industry and in something we could still call full employment? And Mrs. Thatcher at this point, I think, is seen to arbitrate rather than enforce. She's a little like Winston Churchill in the gold standard issue of 1925. And he did not know enough to understand the arguments. And he asked a well-known banker, and the reply was, it will be hell, but you have to do it. Well, by the time that the pound had reached $2.44, and unemployment had reached 10%, and we still weren't there, this was hell already. at least as far as they could see. They didn't know what the future held. And so an element of pragmatism seeped in. After all, I'm not sure the story is apocryphal, but it seems to be worth it anyway. Somebody once asked Nigel Lawson about monetarism, and he said, the conditions for monetarism in Britain do not exist. What are they? Water cannon. Her base in the Treasury alone was not enough against the second thoughts of her colleagues, combined with those of the CBI, the Bank of England, many permanent secretaries, even those who had initially welcomed the change. And, of course, Margaret Thatcher was not blind. She wasn't Captain McQuarrie to drive straight through the middle of the tempest. She was much closer to Lenin, and who bent with the new economic policy. So long as the idea of the rule remains, that is the core, that is the irreversible change. It's not its precise definition. And what we find is that the medium-term financial strategy is actually rebased year on year, 1982 on 81, 1983 on 82, and it represents a slow but significant modification. The order goes out to David Howell not to face up to a miners' strike in 1981. She allows Keith Joseph to bail out bankrupt but key companies. But most significantly, perhaps, a CPRS report is buried in the summer of 1982, although Geoffrey Howe has circulated it to the cabinet. This advocated real right-wing policy, freezing benefits, an insurance-based national health service, education vouchers, and the abandonment of Trident. And she goes on to tell the conference in October, the NHS is safe with us. And as a token, minimum lending rate is pushed down to 12%. So there is an element of flexibility. But equally, like in the Napoleonic War when Wellington was beset by Napoleon's armies, there is a line of Torres Vedras, and the line was held not least because the critics inside the cabinet were eventually dispersed and Prior went to Northern Ireland. A new sort of agenda for public discourse has been set, and I make three points about that. The first is that the focus shifts to inflation and public spending, and not as in the post-war period, unemployment. Even if there was no final answer to the question of which monetary standard, and even if the exchange rate comes in as possibly an alternative instrument, this is established. It's a second part of the 80s, when Nigel Lawson is shadowing the Deutsche Mark, that we get a fuller range of instruments. The second point is that the state itself comes into play, as in fact Berman was kind enough to say in his introduction. And some of the arguments that derive from the Scottish Enlightenment come out. The state is not a source, it is not the sum of benign targets. It's actually a target in itself. And the Heath model, because after all, Heath had seen the state as a powerful instrument for creating economic policy and European policy. There is a step away from that. The third point is the end of the post-war mentality about what the government and the state could actually do. There had been a huge amount of over-optimism in the 30 years since the war about what economic management could do. That had been disproved, and I think virtually all historians would agree that that was so. We go back to the debates of 1944 before the war is over, to the Treasury view of a 10-year balanced budget, to 5% unemployment as the optimum level, not Beveridge's 3% or less. The terms of argument change, and I have to say, but Maynard Keynes himself would probably have disagreed with much of what was done in his name after the war. It is, I think, the single most decisive episode of her 10 years, even if the long-term results were not what was really meant. And the price? Some of this might have happened anyway. It was high. GDP fell in 4 years from 1979 by 3.7%. Unemployment rose to 2.5 million. There was a deep fall in industrial investment. And the capacity of the industrial base declined by 17%. Now one has to ask, was this really capitalism's creative destruction? Only some of it, I suspect. It also created an impetus towards a two-tier society with a low-skilled base level. And this was compounded by the introduction of VAT at 15%, a sales tax. And there were, as we all remember, riots in Toxteth and Southall. And they weren't racial. Perhaps not even Brixton was racial. And there were, of course, real concessions. Perhaps the most important was Lord Scammon's inquiry into Brixton and sending Michael Heseltine as Minister for Merseyside. They weren't just palliatives. They were a real response to what had become seen as an intolerable consequence. I think, as summing up on this question, the anti-inflation aim has become irreversible. We've lived in an anti-inflationary world. Unemployment has been restored at a skilled level. And the same thing that happened here happened, and this is, I think, important. It happened in the Netherlands in 1982. It happened in Ireland in 1987. It happened in Finland in 1990. And the exceptions are those countries that we would call the Rhineland capitalist countries, like Germany, France, and Italy. It's, in this sense, becomes part of the globalizing process, which is to distance it a long way from Mrs. Thatcher herself. She, in private, was driving. She had a public language. She had certainty, allied by a certain flexibility, so long as the core was held. And the regime did begin to work after 1983. The unfortunate thing is that recovery was not in organic growth on the supply side primarily, but through the beneficence of North Sea oil, through a credit and consumer boom, which was not that different from Ronald Reagan's deficit budgeting, an import surge, a huge trade deficit, and the pound down to virtually $1. And that is a mortal paradox. There are three other paradoxes, perhaps, on this question. One is that privatization had never been an oven-ready policy. It had no real prehistory before 1980. The immediate cause in the mid-80s was the need for more revenue, as today in France, and a way to modernize near-bankrupt industries ridden with trade union activity. But one has to point out that British Airways, British Steel, and British Gas were all made profitable by determined new management before privatization. And the question of national monopolies, such as water, was barely posed. British railways were not modernized at all. The second paradox is the management of sterling. There was no future in the pound at $1 and MLR at 14%. You couldn't export in those circumstances. It was too severe. So we have Nigel Lawson in the middle years searching for an exchange rate management instrument. She would not think of entering the ERM. So for 3 years, and she claimed, without her knowledge, Lawson shadowed the Deutschmark when it was actually the center of the ERM at 2 Deutschmarks 90. And it worked. But it didn't affect the boom, it didn't affect the trade deficit much before the bubble went burst. And manufacturing activity did not get back to its 1973 level until 1988. It's little reward for Keith Joseph's very sensible, far-sighted supply-side deregulation. The third paradox is that, obviously, by the 80s, her position had changed. She wasn't at the center. In Lawson's day as Chancellor, she was more distant, preoccupied with external affairs, and she could only stop the move, the final move, into the ERM by recalling Alan Walters to Lawson's dismay and then sacking Lawson And finally, she had to concede ERM entry under Major as the new Chancellor at the wrong time, in the wrong way, and at the wrong exchange rate. By then, she was older, more isolated, and less flexible. And it puts one in mind of Beowulf, the great saga, the last dragon always wins. And the unions. Of course, the unions were not a peripheral matter. Their defeat was what most people now remember. Don't forget, though, that there is a European-wide decline in the membership of trade unions and in their levels of action during these whole last 30 years. Also, it wasn't simply the defeat of trade unions. It was the defeat of wrongful union power. And I should pay tribute to Len Murray. Nobody does much now. And the slow evolution of a more modern unionism by the TUC, which is different from those of the car industry, the steel workers, and the miners, and aided perhaps by the folly and arrogance of one or two of the union leaders themselves. It wasn't a master plan then. That's a later reading. It's Bentham, if you like. There's an element of Dicey on the formation of the state, but its main aim was to end corporatism, not trade unions as such. And the post-war settlement era of brokering the interests of the nation under these different triangular labels ceases. She was, in fact, I think, opposed to all closed corporations, all monopolies, all elites. This is a function of Scott's Enlightenment thinking, after all. That political and economic status rather than simply wages. And the PSBR, the public sector borrowing requirement and cash limits, are weapons to pick off elements like local government. And of course, in the end, she abolished the Greater London Council. To pick off the teachers' unions, to pick off the universities, and the BBC to some degree. Not then, lawyers and doctors. They were a little too difficult. All those become the other with a capital O, the other and the enemy. But this sequence had another consequence, which I should point out. The use of financial instruments, just as much as political ones, by bringing the Treasury into the forefront, centralized state power, even if its actual scope was being diminished, to the detriment not only of the spending departments, but the state's other functions in society at large. And this is aided by cash limits, it's aided by the shrinking of the Department of Trade and Industry, Employment and Education. And one minister was once heard to refer to what he called the former welfare state. There may be an iron law here. The less functions the state has, the more power. And as a counter to that, I would like to mention very briefly the effects on society. Not to quote that much misinterpreted phrase that there's no such thing as society in 1987. I think that's a distraction, even if it's true. She did think things through. She once replied to a question in a private gathering on the difference between public service and public spirit. A slightly suspicious look, but she gave what I think very few prime ministers would ever have given in the post-war period. She gave an honest and careful answer. Public service leads to the overblown state. Public spirit is the key to the good society. And this distinction was enhanced by the rancorous contrast with Heath, his strong state, his European vision, his one nation post-war settlement, based on consensus. She was not consensus-minded. She was also, and always, a successful, largely self-made woman. Her credo was Puritanism rather than Methodism. It's old-fashioned, perhaps unfashionable, but it was not an aversion to society, rather a reliance on the just society, one of England's post-Reformation historical staples. It's not exactly Michael Oakeshott's compassionate civil society, and in that sense, she's not a precursor of the present leadership of the Tory party, and certainly not of Tony Blair. She's much tougher about the role and responsibility of individuals, not afraid of the religious connotation, as her address to the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland showed when she put a new interpretation on the story of the Good Samaritan. She never denied that civil society has to be underpinned by the state, but only in a list of priorities, of which upholding the law, national defence, wise regulation, and the determinant of the national interest are other priorities as well. So to sum up on that, the pains of transition are a sort of purgatorio, preliminary to a virtuous circle. And the decaying city sentence, the bits of rural poverty, the declining options for the unskilled worker, were inevitable elements in the cure. It was sad for her, I think, that her genuine concern about the loss of anchorage in the family and the creation of social outsiders tend now to be ignored, and that her values of work and diligence and deferred gratification are remembered only as facets of a worship of mere accumulation. That's unjust. And the Scarman Report's conclusions were not alien to her. Less noticed, perhaps more serious in the end, for what she once referred to at a CPC meeting as this new Thatcherite democracy was the almost irreversible decline of a mixed 20th century policy with a system of checks and balances which had been enhanced after the First World War crisis. Not just local government, Whitehall, and the role played by the institutions of economic sectors, but the whole range of voluntarism left over from the 19th century. It gets polarized, no one moment, but over time. There's an entrenching of a highly centralized governing process, and perhaps even a managing governing elite, rather more cut off from what had become the mass public in the last 20 years, whose cultural evolution, one has to say, has not exactly emphasized her Puritan values. At the end, because that's where all prime ministers end, Margaret Thatcher and the outside world. It goes almost without saying that it was an English-speaking world where she was most at home, like her frère semblable, Ronald Reagan. Their fundamental accord on the evils of the overmighty state and of communism, their coincidence at the turning point of the Cold War, underpinned their relations. Now, it may be easy, from a British point of view, to poke a bit of fun at Reagan, to see him as laid-back, genial, and rather superficial. That ignores an acute perception of American long-term interests. His marvelous understanding that to win two-thirds of the battle is success, to get three-quarters is exception. And his tolerance of her argumentativeness and his generosity in letting Britain take more of the front row than its weight probably justified. She in turn understood, from her youth in the Second World War, never to choose decisively between America and Europe. That long pendulum swing whose examples have affected what Britain does since the 1890s. So long as Europe was held together in the shadow of the superpowers, so long as the Cold War went on, the British commitment to the European community came second. But that was no longer true by the late 1980s. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, with the fall of the Berlin Wall, Europe was emancipated from fear. And that was a hard point for her to come to terms with, and I suspect she never wholly did. So the answer, the first part of the story, is standing up to the Soviet Union with Reagan's United States. And her understanding that much as she liked and understood Gorbachev, the system that he represented and finally defended had to be destroyed. It was less easy, perhaps, because the American role was more ambiguous, for Britain to stand up to the Argentine generals in the Falklands War. which, in Wellington's famous words, was a damned fine run thing. Both endeavours utterly absorbed her, brought out the best in her, and the most easily defined attributes of leadership. There are other instances. Don't forget the Commonwealth. It wasn't her scene. She didn't share the Queen's views about it. But she didn't follow the right wing in backing Ian Smith in Rhodesia. She didn't go along with the South Africa's apartheid leaders. Instead, she supported Robert Mugabe, who was a very different man then from what he is now. And she supported Samora Machel of Mozambique. Indeed, it may not be generally known that she it was who decided that the SAS should be sent to train the Mozambican army against that awful Renamo force in the Civil War, inspired by Rhodesia in South Africa. She didn't have any sentimental illusions about British influence. She did dislike and despise the corrupt third world leaders, whatever they were, but it wasn't in Britain's interest to do anything about it. Influence depended on arms, and that's why Trident was never in question. And it depended on allies, which is why the United States was never in question. She was able to criticize Reagan for the invasion of Grenada, even if it perhaps was in the American patch. And she was uncritical where basic principles appeared involved. The Russian invasion of Afghanistan was a chance to undermine the evil empire. And that meant support for the guerrillas, the Mujahideen, the jihadists, arms via Pakistan. Not forgetting, of course, arms for Iraq in its struggle with Iran from as early as 1981. And there are two long roots of present discontents. She really did believe that the British experience had something to teach the world, as it did, certainly, in Eastern Europe once the walls came down, and in the 16 years since. She knew that Britain wasn't a world power, but it was a power in the world. And so it was the worst for her. On the last meeting at Camp David with the new president, George Bush, a senior, when he made it clear that German unification in 1990 was a primary interest of the United States and more important than Britain itself. I think that was probably devastating. And that leads, as the late Sir Roy Denman, that ardent European who was fluent in three languages, tried to say to her for a number of years, to Europe, it's unfortunate perhaps that Margaret Thatcher's perceptions of Europe were obscured by economic crisis in 1980-82, by her concentration on the British budget payment, and by what she found unpleasant leaders whom she had to deal with. Nevertheless, the waste of the British presidency in 1981 was a symptom of a fairly deep misunderstanding of European perspectives and a lack of affinity for national leaders. On the other hand, she did fully understand, as all these leaders also did, the vast threats to European industry and to financial survival from American and Japanese industries and banks and their competitiveness. Above all, electronics, electrical goods, cars, steel, chemicals, you name it. These are the multiple sources of the single market creation. The problem was, there was no one like Ronald Reagan out there. Instead, she had a profound suspicion of European socialism, and this was doubled, if anything, when François Mitterrand set off on his Socialism in One Country project in 1981. And she had an equally deep suspicion of Christian democracy in Italy and perhaps also Germany. It's a rebarbative period. There was a futile attempt at bilateral relations, which were long out of date, with France and Germany. And after all, the Franco-German understanding was still the European engine house. Geoffrey Howe was defeated in May 1982 in council, trying to amend the common agricultural policy and reform the budget. At that stage, there's only a few leaders of British industry and perhaps the Bank of England who were pushing for what became the single market. And it took 2 years, preparations which were mostly outside her ambit, the work of the Commission, the work of committees, of trade associations and pressure groups. As the evidence of American and Japanese competitiveness built up and as the recession lifted, and it needed Mitterrand's reversal to a more market-oriented France in 1983 with the help of Jacques Delors before the three fundamental things came together at the summit meeting in summer 1984. Three things were done. The first was that after what had tried everybody's patience almost beyond endurance, a settlement was reached to give a rebate to the British budget. The second was that France at last agreed, after 7 years' obstruction, to admit Spain and Portugal as members. And the third was that Jacques Delors became the president and Arthur Caulfield was put in charge of the single market. Well, Mrs. Thatcher only affected the latter. She voted for Delors, whose qualities I think she did admire at that point. She absolutely insisted on Caulfield. And by 1984, she is thoroughly engaged in the single market project. Of course, in the nature of such things, Mitterrand got the glory, the Germans paid, and Spain and Portugal began their remarkable post-Franco recovery. To complete that astonishing year, in March 1985, Gorbachev comes to power, and these are also, one should add, the best years of the ERM as a Deutschmark zone. Her part, I think, is far more complex than her memoirs suggest. The insistence on Caulfield, who had once been her advisor, and her opposition to the other side of the reform coin. You have the single market on one side, the other side you have what's called social Europe, as defined by Delors, was anathema to her. Put simply, she saw Britain's role as instituting financial discipline and good economic practice in the pursuit of freer trade. And she played her part in realigning the Conservative Party in favour of the single European Act. And in due course, the city institutions woke up to what was in it for them. Once financial services, in which Britain excelled, as it still does in Europe, became part of a single market. She wanted a market-led assault on every barrier to trade, leading to a smaller world for the member states themselves. Caulfield had a narrower definition, remembering that the Single European Act had 285 enactments by the time it was finished. But he didn't include tax harmonization, that was too difficult, and certainly not European Monetary Union. Realistically, she accepted that there were trade-offs, including qualified majority voting in council, and although she had to be outmaneuvered by France and Germany on this, that the process to it should be by intergovernmental conferences rather than by bargaining in the Council of Ministers itself. So you have here, she is being enmeshed. She begins to see herself at that Milan meeting as being beginning not to be trapped, but just her margin of maneuver restricted. Caulfield's empiricism was built from the bottom upwards. There were three barriers: frontier barriers, fiscal barriers, and technical barriers. Even at this stage, what we're now familiar with, competition law and consolidation, are kept for the future. She'd grasped that. She ignored what Delors was doing, the other side of the coin, EMU as a contingent matter, social cohesion. And these are questions, of course, where we still are 20 years later. I won't say nothing has changed. Of course, it needed much more than that. It needed the subtle diplomacy of Luxembourg moving towards the first IGC. It needed the linkage of the Single European Act with Monetary Union, which drew together Caulfield and Delors, and eventually led to her thinking that Caulfield had gone native. It led on to Maastricht. And the genius of the Single European Act was that it offered something for all 12 member states. And for that reason, Britain conceded a lot. QMV, a European Central Bank, a detailed stages to EMU, which was irreversible, as she ought to have known, and I suspect did know, but did not wish to know. And the German leadership was shown very clearly at the Hanover Summit in June 1988, without which it probably could not have been held together. Gofing's 285 enactments were completed after her fall on the 1st of January 1993. After, she claimed to have been misinformed. In fact, after Hanover in 1988, she seems to have been in slow retreat, rather like Napoleon's campaign of 1814. He wins all the tactical battles but loses the war. However, for that brief period, she had had the vision. And if not for that, then what I personally see as the greatest single achievement of European Union, as it became, might have been missed or botched. Her assent, not necessarily her consent, but her assent, ensured that the Commission would acquire its full and proper role, that it should be realigned with the Council of Ministers, that the European Parliament would develop, and that the countries of Eastern Europe, first of all the Nordic ones and Austria, and then the countries of Eastern Europe would come in, as they have done recently. So I think, even in a slightly negative way, she contributed something massively important. The negative side is that afterwards, she goes into reverse gear, and prejudice comes to the top, of which the high mark is probably her speech at Bruges in September 1988, when she declares that there's no substitute for the nation state. What she didn't realize, I suspect, was that the others also lived for their nation states. Helmut Kohl, François Mitterrand, even Andreotti, who's now back in the front line again, aged 87, defended their own national interests and had their own vision of the nation state. Albeit in a different way, and albeit conditioned by their own very different history since World War II. Her stereotypes, I do believe, at Bruges were just that. Stereotypes, they did not fit the facts. And, briefly, there were four damaging legacies left from this to her conservative successors. The first was a failure to use the European instruments to give British policy weight within the Commission. Even by 1994, we had only 3% of top appointments in Brussels, as opposed to the 5% held by France and Germany, and theirs were senior to ours. It happened in the end, but she wasn't the one who gave it a push. And as most prime ministers have done since, she regarded MEPs, members of the European Parliament, as a somewhat inferior species, not alone there. Second legacy was over German unification. Her worldview imagined that the four-power containment of Germany and bilateral relations and NATO and the CFSP would govern the unification of Germany. And to have, for that to have any chance, required the support of the French. Mitterrand wouldn't play, and in due course Mitterrand got the credit for claiming that German unity was a natural function of European Union. And of course, as I've already said, the United States undermined her, it being in American higher interests that German unity come as it did. It also, third point, brought about her own downfall. The other heads of member states had a lot of revenge stirred up by 1989-90. And I'm not necessarily saying there was a conspiracy theory. But by the Madrid summit in 1989, when she was coerced by Howe and Lawson into accepting that the ERM would happen, it was clear to outsiders that she no longer controlled her cabinet, as in 1981. And the manner of ERM entry, with its lack of consultation with other partners, revealed disunity. She had tried, as Howe said in his resignation speech, to be her own foreign secretary, and yet she remained isolated. She never got on with Mitterrand. When Kohl, Helmut Kohl, made an attempt to conciliate at Diedesheim in December 1988, she rebuffed him. And in the last 18 months, she acquired a dangerous obsession with a Christian Democrat socialist conspiracy for Brussels domination. Hence what somebody has called of the Bruges speech, not a policy, but a spasm. By the Dublin summit, she was in the minority of 1-11, and she may well have been manipulated at the final October 1990 IGC meeting in Rome by Andreotti and others. But if she was, it's only true to say that she had isolated herself even from her own colleagues. And of course, after she'd gone, as one journalist of my acquaintance remarked, there was a widespread soulagement. And John Major got his opt-out from monetary union, partly because he was not Margaret Thatcher. And the last point of her legacy is the incipient civil war in the party, which is still there. And I think perhaps I don't have the time to say much about that. The civil war was breaking out even before she went. And Major's time made it worse. One might ask, did she ever ask the question about the European Union, not as a federal government, but as what the Germans call a Staatenverbund, an association of nation states, each for their own and for the greater good? It's a good question. You can get different answers across the whole European subcontinent. And did she ever reflect that what she always called they, rather than we, by which I mean Wales and Scotland, that the Scots and the Welsh did better from Region A between 1975 and 1987 than any other region in the whole of Europe except parts of Italy's south? There's no simple conclusion. I'm not even going to try to give you one. Remember that great book by Peter Kyle, Napoleon For and Against. Maybe it's not possible to achieve a synthesis. And what Thatcherism meant back in 1981 is now so diverse and so stereotyped that I refer you to a speech made by Geoffrey Howe over the Stuttgart Declaration. It's like hanging baubles on a moving Christmas tree. Thatcherism, in my opinion, was what she believed. We don't require political leaders to be original thinkers. She drew on many sources. Puritan, Scott's Enlightenment, Max Weber, as well as Hayek and Friedman. We do expect political leaders to declare and implement what they believe with conviction, if elected, and she did. So I'll make five very quick points. There is an enduring change of outlook about the modern industrial state and the limits of what government can do, and what priorities and resources should be in a medium-range power. Secondly, the aim of the modern industrial state should be counter-inflation with an orientation towards financial discipline, spreading across economic organization, not just the political domain. Of course, that built, as I've suggested, on Healey's turning in 1976. It leads to a fundamental cost-benefit analysis of the state and its duties. Third point, with America, it helped to capture change as the Soviet Union fell apart and in Eastern Europe as rebuilding began. And if you go around Eastern Europe, you will find much praise for Mrs. Thatcher. It's a brief but deliberately vital point in the evolution of the European Union as we now know it. But of course, it has evolved in ways of which she did not later approve. She herself was an executor of great determination rather than an originator, in the sense that Keith Joseph was an originator. At the price, of course, of successions of colleagues. She was almost reckless at the end. She divided, she did not unite the party. And finally, she was driven from within, rather lonely, She lived for her work. She was adrift after 1990. She was argumentative. She led from the front. She would have laughed at the story of Ledru Rollin, that French minister in one of the revolutions of the 19th century, found at the back of the crowd in the streets, and they said, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "Je suis le chef, il faut que je les suive." Not her. She knew her mind. She had no need for focus groups to tell her what to think. She exposed differences. She inflamed debate. She outstayed her time. But then so did Roosevelt, and no. She wasn't Mr. Jefferson to retire to Monticello, her political work done. But if I can adapt a line from Stephen Spender, she left the vivid air signed with her brightness.
For all information, please go to our website at www.gresham.ac.uk.